introduce myself.
Oh, yes. Cool.
Like I said, my name is Mary. I'm in the UK.
My name is Yerusalem Gurmai. I'm a member of the Tagaru Professionals Network, and I am based in Las Vegas, Nevada.
And I am Hannah Ruta. I host the Uprooted podcast, and I am based in Denver, Colorado. Also a member of TPN and the local Tagaru community of, or I guess works technically Denver, but it's Aurora. So yeah.
Hey guys, my name is Soretti. I am Oromo. I'm an artist, facilitator, activist. Grew up in Melbourne, born in Adama, currently in Nairobi, and happy to be here.
That's quite a journey.
Yes.
Yeah. How did, if you don't mind me asking, how did you end up there?
In Nairobi?
Yeah.
Okay, so I was here years ago as part of like a longer trip across a couple of different countries on the continent, and I really loved it, and I was attempting to stay longer at that point, but I got sick and had to go back to Australia. And then from about December last year, wow, it's been a year now, December last year until like about 2 weeks before Hutch Arnold's assassination, I was living and working in Ethiopia. And then I went back to Australia for what was supposed to be like a couple months. Then Hutch Arnold was assassinated, kind of changed my life. Couldn't really bear being like a continent away from Ethiopia. Couldn't go back to Ethiopia either because of security risks and still can't go back for obvious reasons. So I said, and I was advised by my peers and close networks that I should go to Nairobi. So I've been here for nearly 4 months now.
That's pretty amazing. I was like, I've only ever lived in the States, so I don't know. Moving from one state to another was like dramatic enough for me.
Like, oh god. Like, my dad calls me a nomad. So
you definitely are.
Yeah, I can definitely see it.
Y'all should come one time. If you ever come, let me know. Or if you come nearby even, let me know.
I was literally like, so I
that's on the bucket list.
Yeah, I tried to go like 3 times to that side of the world, and like every time something like dramatic happened where like I couldn't go anymore.
Really?
Are you referencing Kenya or Australia?
No, I'm saying like to the other side of the planet, period. Like I tried to go to Europe. Yeah, like I tried to go to Europe last Christmas, and then we were supposed to like go and travel around different places in Africa. Kenya was on the list because it's like right there. So I was like an easy jump from Ethiopia to Kenya, you know, and that, yeah, horrible tragedy. And then this year I tried to go for my birthday in March and then Corona. And then I was supposed to go again this year for Christmas, and now we're in a war. So it's like, I literally could not make it to that side of the planet. Like, ridiculous.
Wow, sis, wow. That is, those are really quite dramatic things that have happened.
Yeah, it's dramatic. I'm like, dude, okay, God, I heard you. I'm not going. Yes. I will stay put. Jesus Christ. He was like playing with my emotions. It's like, I just want to see my people. Can I be with the people? Like,
maybe you could try West Africa. Like, it's closer. Maybe it's the kilometers that he doesn't want you to be traveling.
I know. Yeah, that's maybe. We'll see if I can try that. But I'm gonna wait till Corona stops.
that's advisable.
Like, yeah, it's at this point. It doesn't even make sense. Like, nobody wants us. Our U.S. passport doesn't even let us in anywhere anymore because all the countries are like blockading us. Besides, like, some Latin American countries.
Is it?
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't even know that. That's so bad.
Sad, sad day. I can't wait for Trump to leave so that we can like so we can be respected on the global scale again, because he's anyways, that's a whole nother tangent.
Yeah. Just to ask, how many like has everyone been back to Ethiopia? Or like
Yeah.
I've been 4 times. I usually go every 3 years. I was planning to go. We were planning a trip actually with TPN this December, but it got canceled because of the imminent war that was looming at the time. It hadn't started yet. And also because of the COVID. Yourself, have you been?
I have, yeah. I've been 3 times, 2 of them when I was little. And then the last time I went was 7 years ago. That's the one that I properly remember. And we've been trying to go since, but like it hasn't been stable. So my parents were like, nah, next year, and then next year comes and it's not calmed down, and then next year again. So yeah, hopefully everything will calm down and be able to go. But yeah.
And what part of Ethiopia are your family from, Mary?
Tigray. Well, we're everywhere, not just, but like we are from Tigray, yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, from when did y'all feel like the, you know, the war was imminent? I was talking to some of my Tigray friends in Melbourne and they were saying like from March.
I think we figured that tensions had been escalating by the regional party and the prosperity party, I guess you can say, since like 2018. And obviously since the election was held by Tigray in September 9th, that it felt like also it was imminent then as well. It's hard to say a specific time frame because tensions just gradually increased between the two parties. I know I actually talked to my cousin November 3rd, and she's based in Tigray. And I asked her, hey, how's it going with the locust invasion? And how's everything? And she said, you know, that's another story, but we're really worried about war. And then the next day, telecommunications is shut off. So it felt, I think for a lot of Tigrayans, it didn't feel like if, it was when. Mm. So, and unfortunately, we're coming into this scenario that we find ourselves in now.
Before we proper get into it, let me just quickly give like the listeners a little brief on like what we're going to talk about. All right, so this episode is about having a conversation, sharing thoughts and feelings about what is happening in Ethiopia. My aim is to draw attention to the current events, but to also further my understanding about why this is happening and obviously everybody else's understanding by having these types of conversations. In doing this, I want to demonstrate how easy it can be to just have an open dialogue. I would have really loved to have had been able to have at least one guest from like every different region of Ethiopia, but it's proven quite difficult. But I'm glad that we're here having this conversation, and hopefully by doing this, it will inspire others to do the same. So yeah, again, I really appreciate you guys coming on, and yeah, so let's get into it. We've already done introductions. So I sort of wanted to start with like a little bit of the history to just, because I don't think it just came out of nowhere. So I was really trying to look for like exactly when was like Ethiopia established, because it wasn't always Ethiopia, it was Abyssinia, right? So I found that it was 10th century BC. So this is when it was Abyssinia. And then by the 2nd century AD, we had the kingdom of Axum. And then by Johannes's time, that's when it was starting to become a little bit. Fast forward a bit, we had Haile Selassie, who ruled from 1930 to 1974. He had the airlines, stuff like that, that he introduced, but then he was overthrown by Mengistu. There's a lot of history which comes with him too, but he ruled from 1977 to 1991, and then he was also overthrown by what we recently had, which was the EPRDF. I know this doesn't go into much detail of like everybody's rule, but that's how it came to having the TPLF, the Amhara Democratic Party, the Oromo Democratic Party, and it was like a sort of...
The southern regions.
Yeah, that's it. So we had that coalition from 1991, and Melis was the assumed prime minister at that time, but then he had been the prime minister since then, up until when he died in 2012. And then we had PM Hailemariam, who took over from him until Abiy came into power in 2018 after Hailemariam's resignation.
Can I just make one clarification of something that you said? For the EPRDF, they weren't the ones that actually overthrew Mengistu Hailemariam. It was actually a party that was established after he was overthrown. Just want to make that clarification.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Sorry, that's my bad. I worded it wrong. Yeah.
It's okay.
Good clarification. A couple things about, I think that we need to be clear about the way we articulate how, if what the relationship even between those parties were to the people and also to each other. But the first thing I wanted to say was talking about the Ethiopian history, which is when you asked the question, I was like, damn, do we even want to, because there are so many different versions that people use as, you know, their central narrative. And it's weird to think that there can be many versions of a history of a country, right? And I think that's what it's the case with Ethiopia. There are so many different narratives that omit or focus on different rulers, perceive them completely differently. And this makes for what I think is one of the most polarizing political discourses we have probably on the planet at the moment. Because even when we go as far back as our history, there is not one narrative. So some things about that narrative, the idea that Ethiopia, you know, sort of, there are versions of Ethiopia or ideas of Ethiopia existing beyond, before it became a state, perhaps in the Bible, or like they're just, there's Ethiopia in a lot of different contexts. There's a line that Gamachu Magarsa says when he's an Oromo anthropologist, and he goes, if you ask him about Ethiopia, which Ethiopia are you talking about? And he names like three different kinds of Ethiopia, right, in terms of their historical context. And I really wish I remember that line clearly. I did years ago because I just loved it so much, but I don't. But I just want to bring attention to it because he's getting us to think about the fact that there are so many different narratives of what Ethiopia is. But if we're talking about the state Ethiopia, this was an invention much closer to like the beginning of the 19th century that really begun to take form at the beginning of the 19th century. And it wasn't as much, you know, Ethiopia existed somewhere else and then became everywhere else. It was the Abyssinian culture and identity, which, you know, is like the northern highlands, particularly Amhara. And then there's, you know, similarity between Amhara and a Tigray or Tigaro culture. But particularly that highland Amhara culture, that Abyssinian culture, deciding that it wanted to expand. And this is the version, as I said, there are many versions. This is a version that is the backbone of my understanding of modern day Ethiopia today, right? So this highland Abyssinian, you know, northern culture, worldview, empire really, deciding it wanted to expand and coming down towards southern, western, sort of eastern regions. And for some time, for decades, really initiating, you know, an assimilation and colonization process that was extremely brutal. And before that, there was the existence of multiple, you know, indigenous nationalities and nations, which is why today Ethiopia is referred to as a nation of, you know, nations, nation of nations, because in becoming a modern state and recognized, this is complicated. You know, there are people within the borders we've defined that lived sovereign from the identity of Ethiopia before this and could want the same thing again. So how do we accommodate for that was the question around the time that the Derg fell and before the EPRDF was formed. For the Oromo narrative, coming into the state context of Ethiopia, it's not a process of will, it was a process of, you know, it's too costly to continue to resist this. You know, the death toll's too high. We need to continue to struggle in other ways. But yeah, so I think that distinction can be important in this conversation. The other thing, just in terms of the relationship between those parties, in the EPRDF, which I think is the more sensitive part of our conversation today, perhaps. And, you know, I want to take care in having that conversation because the climate you'll find yourselves in, what I mean, Jan, I'm talking about, you know, your sisters here and your community finds yourself in is deeply devastating, is deeply unjust. And, you know, I think we'll go more into it, but in no way by trying to talk a little bit into these complexities, am I wanting to deny that or even decenter that at this point in time? But, you know, so the relationship between those parties, we did see a domination of the TPLF for that 27 years, and the rest of the EPRDF was really an extension of the TPLF's power. It's widely recognized, like I would probably say 100% consensus amongst the Oromo community, that the OPDO was not a representative of the people, or was not a representative of even the Oromos who fought for that change, right, to see the Derg overthrown. That was the Oromo Liberation Front that was even fighting alongside the TPLF for many years, and the other parties that you had mentioned, Mary, to see that change come about. But when that coalition was formed, it really was about developing a monopoly on power on behalf of the TPLF. And so that coalition, although many recognize it, and I myself also recognize it as probably one of the greatest opportunities in terms of structure, political structure, to allow for Ethiopia's multinational federation, which was what was established in the constitution at that 1991 to 1995 period, where people, regions, Oromia, Tigray, Amhara, Ogaden, southern peoples, nations, I cannot remember the whole abbreviation all the time. No, please forgive me to our peoples from there who are listening.
And nationalities, but, yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Yerusalem.
Yeah. So that structure was supposed to allow for that autonomy to be realized. It didn't, but it was still identified to be the most relevant structure to eventually allow that autonomy. So when that was dissolved by Abiy to create the Prosperity Party, you know, that was really seen as a huge threat for all people invested in that structure of autonomy, of regional autonomy and representation. And the last thing I want to say is, like, you know, Abiy came in to his position as a leader of a transitional process, of a transitional government. That was his position. He was not elected by anybody. He came out of the Oromo People's Democratic Organization, OPDO, via, you know, an internal reform system that was in the works for many years. So it's important. I think a lot of people I keep saying things like, then the Prosperity Party won. I'm like, won what? They didn't want anything. The homie came out of a party and, like, now he's here and he wants to establish a dictatorship. I don't know what you're talking about. Won what? Came from where? So, yeah, I'm going to stop there. I think that's the question.
No, I think you bring up very good points, because I think that what I've noticed in the rhetoric, right, that's surrounding these issues is this kind of, like, everyone, you're right, everyone has a narrative of what they feel like Ethiopia is or how it came to be. And it's kind of like, it makes it so difficult to even have a conversation, because we're not all, like, having a dialogue based off the same facts. Like, we all have, like, I feel like in the last 4 years with Trump, right, we have this stupid narrative, right, where, like, there's fake news and this is not fact or whatever. And then I'm seeing that same rhetoric, at least in the diaspora, of the same thing, where it's like, well, that's not true, and this is not right, and this is not facts. And so it's very difficult to have a conversation if we're not all operating on the same idea and the same history, because I think that all of our personal biases, you know, show up as well. It's like, well, this is what happened to us, and this is what happened to them. And, like, everyone has a different version of who was responsible, who was in power, who, like, why did these things happen, who overthrew, like, this ruler, and why did they do it? So it kind of just gets a little bit ridiculous for the average person trying to follow this. You're like, what? Like, I thought, like, politics in general were complicated, like Ethiopian politics, like that, like, oh my god, it's, I don't even know if we can call it politics at this point. Like, it's so hard to follow, you know.
Just, you know, adding on to what you said, Ethiopia's identity is largely tied to the diversity in its people, with the over 80 ethnic groups. We also see that it's largely grounded in the two dominant religions, Christianity and Islam. And I think, echoing your guys' sentiments, depending on the ethnic group, history will tell different stories compared to also even Western perspectives. We see that Ethiopia, there's kind of a national pride in that, the fact that we were never colonized and that we have this beautiful diversity. And we have stemmed from monarchies to what we have now, the absolution of that. And depending on who you ask, one person, and by one person I'm referring more so to an ethnic group, one person's hero or who they idolize would be villainous to another. And that is seen throughout, I think, Ethiopian history, as we know, with a lot of the people in leadership being overthrown, even more so recently. In the past couple of decades, we've seen countless instances of that. So our beauty is in our diversity, and our diversity is in our history. And history shows us that it's very hard to tell when who are the people really writing our histories, who are writing our stories. Often the minority groups, and I'm talking about minority groups, not including Amhara, Tagaru, the smaller populations, they're often omitted from history books. So, I mean, even in the context of this conversation that we're having, they're not participating. So we're not going to be able to obviously hear a lot of voices that are often left voiceless for the much larger mm-hmm. populations dominating Ethiopia. But I hope this opens up a discourse for us to kind of enable those kind of discussions and to hear from the much smaller minority populations as well.
Yeah, I don't know how everyone else feels, so I should just speak for myself. And I just think that, like, when I did start to learn about these things, I always thought that was so disrespectful that it was just lumped into the southern region and nationalities as if they weren't, like, you know, unique cultures in and of itself, you know, like, I'm like, oh, so you guys are just all the South? Like, what does that even mean? Like, what is your, like, I mean, obviously, when I remember hearing like 83 languages, I was like, how the heck do we operate a country with so many different dialects, you know? But I think that, like, if we are to treat, like, the idea of being multinational means that you actually have to recognize all of the different nationalities within it.
Right. And even in that context, Ruth, you know, we've seen the Wolaita people who have been agitating for more autonomy and who want to be recognized separate from, you know, from Sidama and from the southern peoples, nations and nationalities, and the crackdown that's happened there, the arrest of political leaders, the military assault on protesters, like the aversion that those who want to keep monopoly on power have to acknowledging this diversity, because it means power is less and less centralized, right? If you keep mm-hmm. sort of giving it out, and essentially that's great. Yeah. But it's been the crux of the political question of Ethiopia, you know, forever, because it means moving away from what the establishers of Ethiopia wanted. And that memory is still a really big part of, like, Ethiopia's DNA, like the one culture, one language, one religion. And although, you know, Amhara do make up a minority of the country, that's really even what the conflict is right now, is this an attempt to recolonize, essentially, to reestablish this one language, this one culture, this one national identity. You know, this dream that it's really dangerous. People will always respond with resistance when you deny them the opportunity to be who they are. And then, as we're saying, when we have such diversity in Ethiopia, it's extremely dangerous to try and establish this kind of singularity. And again, although the Amhara people are a minority in the country, and it is not necessarily like your average Amhara person who is responsible for this, you know, for this historic assimilation and colonization, and now this reperpetuation of this assimilation, it is really amongst the elite. There, you know, there isn't enough knowledge we have about each other in that country. Y'all have been back, you probably know this, to be able to question it and, like, you know, acknowledge where the problems are and refuse, you know, and reject that this is not what I represent as an individual Amhara person. So you have these people in power who are using, you know, the fact that there isn't this knowledge available to people, and people can't build the solidarity at grassroots level entirely to manipulate these relationships and these historic grievances, you know, so that they can remain in power and they can continue to, yeah, establish this monopoly of not just power politically, but also power culturally, power linguistically, power and identity. Yeah.
And I think that Addis Ababa, for the most part, kind of portrays a disillusioned utopia for what Ethiopia is. It's kind of a hallmark of, this is where everybody's welcome. It belongs to no one. It's not part of any of the 10 regions. And we know, you know, Amharic being the official language, and who are the majority of the people there? How are they represented? When things do go down, such as the civil war or there's political uprising, which ethnic groups are getting ostracized? Which of them are experiencing ethnic cleansing and being forced out of the city? And we're seeing a rise of that, especially in recent years. And this, it's not to say that this started in the past 2 years. Obviously, we have means of communication and social media platforms, so that way it's getting more public. I think the idea of Ethiopia, especially in an African context, it's kind of this ideal country that was never colonized and prospered. And with that prosperity, using that term, comes at the hand of many deaths, many mistreatments of ethnic minorities, abuse of power, and this goes on for centuries. So it is really disheartening, even with the SNPR, you know, they have a population of over 11 million people. And if you see, I think there's probably around 45 ethnically indigenous people to that area. And creating, grouping them all together with such ethnic, linguistic diversity automatically ostracizes a lot of the minority populations. And that's just one. You know, I think also Somali they make up a significant percentage of the population of Ethiopia, and they are largely marginalized. And, you know, that's a voice that we don't often hear from. And they have been, though, expressive in their disdain of how things are going in Ethiopia, especially for their population. So it's, I think the idea of Ethiopia, and it's kind of like Ethiopia first, and it's like, okay, when you say Ethiopia first, who are you really referring to? What does your idea of Ethiopia first mean? And oftentimes we find that when it's one's own ethnic group is in a good space, and whether that's being free from political imprisonment or being free from extrajudicial killings or just massacres and atrocities, that's when it feels like that is the Ethiopia that they're really promoting in terms of like Ethiopia first mentality. Even now with kind of people taking on the whole Trump slogan and saying make Ethiopia great again, and it's like in a historical context, when was it great and for who was it great? And that's a question you get different answers from everyone. I've personally heard, you know, people say they miss when the Derg was in power. And then obviously for a lot of people, that was a tumultuous and terrible time and a stain on Ethiopia's history. People could say the same thing about the subsequent government, and people are saying that currently about the Prosperity Party. So it's just, you know, we're in a unique space in terms of our history, where it's very hard to determine like what is the right way to govern Ethiopia with so much ethnic, linguistic diversity and viewpoints as to what makes Ethiopia great to begin with and what it really for. And I think, you know, even dismantling or just really dissecting the idea of like Ethiopia first and always, we hear there's been growing, I think, more sentiment for like regional autonomy. And kind of, you know, a lot of ethnicities are kind of saying, you know, my ethnicity first. I am this before I'm, you know, we hear I'm sometimes like I'm Tigrayan before I'm Ethiopian. I'm Oromo before I'm Ethiopian and stuff like that. And that's a result of feeling disenfranchised. And I think that also has to be kind of looked into, just kind of what does patriotism mean in current Ethiopian context and previous Ethiopian context. I think that's something also to dissect.
I kind of want to speak for like what I hear is a lot of people's personal experience in terms of growing up being from Tigray. Let me just even speak for myself. Like, I think that until I was maybe 7 or 8, I didn't realize there was a different way to be Ethiopian. I think I had bought into this idea that Ethiopia was just this one country. Everybody was Ethiopian, but everybody like spoke a different language, which still in my young mind didn't make it sense, because I was like, you know, in the US, even though it's the same thing, right? Like English isn't the official language, but we all recognize it as the language that is spoken, right? So that's how I related it too, right? I didn't really think that, I didn't know enough of the history to understand where these things were coming from. So it was like Ethiopia was, you know, quote unquote, one country. And then for some reason, Amharic was the national language. Like, I didn't realize where that thinking came from, why that decision was made. And I didn't even grow up understanding Amharic. So I was just like, okay. Like, you know, like, I guess it's the language that they use, but it's not the language that I know. And not until I was older did I start to realize, like, oh, wait, no, like, it's not just that we speak different languages. It's that we are, essentially, we're all different people. And we decided, you know, and we can be very loosely, right? Like, we personally didn't decide, but it was decided to become one country, right? And there's, like we said earlier, there's a bunch of context around that. So in that, like, I really think for, like, what I see it visually as is more like what it should run if you're talking about multinational governing. It's kind of like the United Nations. Like, the United Nations is a bunch of different countries and they have a common goal, right? And that's ideally what it could have been if we actually, like, executed on the ideology that we are a bunch of different nations and the common goal is to prosper our land, you know, to prosper all of our people, to get out of poverty, to get out of killing each other constantly, and, like, and also just the outside forces, like the people who actually want to colonize us. But here we are constantly dealing with internal conflicts of different groups trying to colonize everybody to be the same. And I don't know if that's an oversimplification, but, like, I think from someone who might not understand all of the politics, that's kind of how I summarize what we're talking about. Like, each different regime is, you know, in one way, shape, or form, trying to shape Ethiopia the way they want to see it. And I think that the agreement that had originally been made to let's recognize each culture in each region was a good, like, idea. It just didn't get executed properly. And had they done that, and had they also taken the time to recognize, like, we're not going to just be able to come back together because 2 seconds ago we were all fighting. So you can't just assume that the people on the ground who were experiencing this, who were being brutalized and victimized and harassed and massacred, how do you expect them to turn around and be like, fine, we're one nation, without acknowledging all of the different pain that each group had suffered over, you know, all of these centuries of different regimes. Like, I think that part of the dialogue was kind of dismissed and it was agreed upon by leadership. And I think that's why we see that the people on the ground didn't fall in line necessarily, in my eyes. And you guys can, you know, if I'm oversimplifying it, like I said, I'm just trying to say it, like, from an outsider's perspective, because I don't know enough about all of the details of the history. And I'm also just paying attention to the rhetoric that I see online between all the different ethnic groups, and especially the youth who don't really know what they're talking about, but, like, spew out, you know, like, just random facts all the time, but give it no context. And I'm like, well, do you know why they say that? Do you know how they suffered? Do you know, like, what wars their parents fought in for their rights and, like, different things? So I think that it's one of those things that maybe we can say each pride has, or each group has in common, that we don't always recognize the other group's pain and suffering, because nobody wants to look like the bad guy. Nobody really wants to be like, oh, we were a part of that process. Like, we were part of the group that hurt the other group. Because if you think about it, every ethnic region has a boogeyman, you know, every ethnic region has someone that is responsible for their pain and suffering in their mind, in their narrative. Like, I can't say for certain who did what to who, but just from the rhetoric, you can tell that each group has a gripe with another one, if that makes sense.
Just to add on, sorry, just to add on to what you were saying, you see how you said that like, every region has a boogeyman, and, like, the leadership, they're not acknowledging that, and they're not, like, saying, oh, okay, yeah, so and so did this wrong and this happened, yeah, we know this happened and we fully accept that, we acknowledge it. You see, what do you think about the way that Abiy came into power? Because there are times where he did he apologized, he asked the people of Ethiopia to forgive him for what happened. And like, so basically the question is, what do you think about the current leaders?
I think it's really important to understand that even if it wasn't super obvious to everyone, actually, I don't think it was obvious to anyone, including those closest to him, including those who fought for him to even take that position. It wasn't obvious to him or to them or us, but if we reflect with nuance, it's clear that he entered his position with ambitions for a dictatorship. And he did a lot of things that would position him as likable and charming. And he played a lot of the right cards at the beginning of his leadership. But honestly, I don't even think it matters anymore. I don't think it's mattered for a very long time, actually, what he did at the in the first like 3-4 months of his
tenure.
You know, yeah. And I do like, you know, it's a lot of like the public conversation and the media narrative is, it kind of frames him as like, oh, someone who started off, who welcomes back the political opposition, you know, who has now arrested the political opposition, who has now seen a lot of the political opposition on the side of the Oromo Liberation Front, you know, have been killed in the country, or, you know, so it's kind of like, it doesn't really, you know, it's like, let's look at what his actions are kind of reflecting now, what kind of sentiments they're reflecting now. I think that he underestimated. There's actually a really good article that I think everyone should read. It's called In Depth, Ethiopia's Democracy Derailed, and it's written by Jawar Mohammed, who's currently in prison. It was written before he was in prison, but just released recently. And he was a key architect, very close to Abiy and other members of the people who were forwarding this reform inside the OPDO at the time, the Oromo People's Democratic Organization, and also leading a lot of like the involved in a lot of the grassroots movement as well. And so he really gives a very personal recount of his perception of Abiy from the beginning. He was opposed to Abiy taking power from the beginning and explains why. And, you know, I think it gives good context to really what Abiy's ambitions looked like from the onset. So I think like it's what he's done that we really need to pay attention to. He got this Nobel Peace Prize for brokering deal with Eritrea. And I can't speak on this as much as like I've been able to really pay attention to what Eritrean activists have been saying about this peace deal, which is it's nothing. It's empty. He hasn't actually created any meaningful change for the people, right? You know, we talked about the political prisoners being released, sure, but now you've got 30,000 or more political prisoners in Oromia alone, right? You have some of the most high-profile political opposition in the country, or Oromo political opposition in the country, in prison on the most, like, ramped-up, bogus terrorist charges you could possibly imagine. And there's evidence for this, right? There's evidence of people in prison who were told, if you want to get out of prison, we need a false testimony from you against X, Y, and Z. So I think... you know, and I think everyone has access to a public archive of what Abiy says about how he wants to govern. You know, you have an organization or a political party planning for 10 years of governance when you're supposed to be a transitional committee to election. Mm-hmm. These things should tell us enough about who he is. And again, like, he really tried to play the unifying card, and he really believed himself because he is an Oromo, and because he came off the bat of like a long 4 years plus civil movement where, you know, Oromo youth were really at the forefront of that until like, you know, the last kind of quarter of it, or even less, last fifth, sixth of it, and came off of that. And Oromo, first Oromo prime minister of the country, really used that to his advantage. He really articulated himself to the Oromo population, at least, as the end of our struggle for this self-determination in the country. And if people didn't recognize him as the end of the struggle for self-determination, you were a threat to him, a.k.a. Haj Alu. This was what he articulated himself to Haj Alu as being, you know, there's no need for you to make this kind of protest music, this political music anymore, this, you know, this music of resistance anymore. I'm here. Like, what else do you really want, right? Mm-hmm. And this is really, it's really interesting to me. I always think, like, actually not for a second did any of that movement ask for an honorable prime minister. That was never any demand. That was not in the demands. I don't know where that came from. But again, like, he fit an image that made people really like comfortable, especially the West, but also us as well. Like, but yeah, especially the West were really excited. Like, okay, this could really be, you know, the turning point Ethiopia's that Ethiopia has been hoping for. This could lull a lot of tensions, perhaps even resolve a lot of tensions. But Abiy does not have, never did have, and this is to sort of what you were saying earlier, sorry, Jerusalem?
Jerusalem,
forgive me. You were saying earlier about, like, how do you govern a nation as complex as Ethiopia? And I don't think Abiy had the foresight, you know, the attentiveness, the mindfulness, the ability to pay attention to nuance and make sense of nuance in the way that our complexity needs generally, but also needed at that moment that he came into power, you know, a really precarious moment. And I think I'm reflecting a lot of ideas from that article because it really resonates with me. I also wanted to say that, like, on the part of the Oromo, at least, and I'll speak from this perspective in regards to this, Ethiopia as you know, as an identity to choose instead of the identity of being an Oromo, you know, is, I think it sounds easy, and like people can't get why it can't happen because they perceive being an Oromo as a cultural identity and a linguistic identity. And then, of course, then there is a space for the national identity, right? But if you're being an Oromo is also a national identity, it's a very nationalist identity. The Oromo nationalist movement is what even, you know, brought a lot of Oromos to identify as Oromo. Really, this movement led by the Oromo Liberation Front to create a unifying national identity amongst Oromos. So the national, Oromo national consciousness is really what has led figures like Jawaharlal Muhammad, but just also like your general population of young people, of politically conscious people in Oromia to be agitating for this regional autonomy is, yes, to protect rights of cultural expression and to protect against cultural assimilation and et cetera. But it's really from a place of nationalism. And that's the thing Ethiopia set itself up to allow was competing nationalisms. But once we actually saw those competing nationalisms emerge, and at the beginning it was the Oromo Liberation Front, immediate reaction to that was a crackdown. And that's been, it's like been a reflex that Ethiopia has not been able to break out of, that every time, you know, someone or people do something that it doesn't like, it's not necessarily bad, it's not dangerous, but it just doesn't like, it doesn't feel like it's falling in line enough. And we see this a lot in Abiy's rhetoric with Tigray, with even Jawaharlal Muhammad and Bikila Garba, goes, we were so patient, we waited for what exactly, this is not really articulated, but we can kind of infer that we kind of waited for y'all to align with what we're doing, right? We waited for y'all to agree with us and you didn't, so we took this action. That culture of crackdown, I think, is important to pay attention to. Like, and the other thing too is Ethiopia has never had a competitive, diverse political environment. It's never been allowed to be developed. It's never had a democratic election. The country has never had a democratic election. And like, okay, forget the, you know, 100 years before, decades before, where there wasn't the political infrastructure for that. But even the last 30 something years now, there's never been a democratic election. There have been attempts at elections that have, I think, are accepted quite widely to have not been fair and free. You know, so it's, you know, it's a country that has a small space of political, diverse political thought, and that's mostly amongst it is created in a hierarchy where you have mostly an elitist community who engage in that. And that's been changing over the last 5, 6, 7 years, where you're seeing these popular movements at the grassroots who are politically aware and conscious calling for change. But for the most part, it's like a couple of people that are having these conversations, right? And I would say that in that conversation, the binary looks like, okay, an Ethiopia that transcends our diverse national identities, an Ethiopia that creates the space for them to exist somewhat side by side and, you know, grow in the directions that they want to grow. And I guess the kind of last thing I want to say is that there can be no such thing as an ethnically neutral identity in Ethiopia, because where does that land us? Like Finfinne, as you were saying, what is like seen, or Tababa is seen as being the place, and people even want it. I've heard people say, how can we replicate the model of Addis Ababa elsewhere, of Infinite elsewhere? And that's really disturbing to me, because what people are perceiving, and I can understand that, is it's the place of, like, I won't even say it's a place of most diversity, but yeah, it's got a lot of diversity. But in Oromia, you see this kind of diversity as well. There are pockets everywhere where you're seeing high levels of diversity. My friend was telling me, like, yeah, like there's just a lot of diversity in a lot of places, but obviously the capital city is like where you pay attention to when you think about like development infrastructure wise, when you think about development, like even
also the host of the African Union. I think that plays a large part to it.
Right. But when you think about what that ethnic neutrality looks like, where does it land us? It lands us on Amharic as a language, lands us on a kind of optic of Ethiopian identity, like the visual of Ethiopian identity that looks a certain way. And I think everyone can kind of draw up an image when I say that, right? And that's kind of centralized, and that's reflected again. And then you have your sort of moments of, you know, representation. Oh, this is like somewhere else in the country, but back to your main, you know, sort of, again, your main optic. So that idea is just quite illogical that we can land on a place of neutrality. So if we think about what does it mean for us to actually coexist, I mean, we're at a point of no return, and I think this conversation would have looked very different, you know, a while ago as to now. But, you know, and we've seen communities who have been pushing not just for regional autonomy, but, you know, political factions of communities that have also been pushing for secession since Ethiopia became a modern state. You know, the OLF, although of recent, the Oromo Liberation Front is what I mean when I say the OLF, although of recent have been participating in the sort of mainstream political space before this, and even now really pushed the idea that, you know, Oromia does need to be independent to be able to be free of tyranny, to be able to be safe, to be able to be not exploited. And now we're seeing a lot of this sentiment, or at least I'm seeing a lot of the sentiment, and where is that? It's like through my networks and Twitter, amongst the Tagaro community, right, for this secession. And that was always accepted to be somewhere we could land. And it's even in the constitution. And I think it's fascinating, although I don't really, it's a whole other conversation as to what it means to achieve that secession or that independence via the constitution. But I think it's very important to note that it was placed there for a reason. It's because it could always happen. It was always, our unification was always that fragile. And I think the question is, like, for me, when we talk about governance, it really always has to come back to what's the best for your majority? What's the best for your communities on the ground, for your grassroots population? Not what's the ideal that you want to protect? What's the ideal you want to forward by any means necessary? And so if that reality is moving forward to fragmentation, and that's going to work better for us, I don't know. Yeah, for me, it's like, well, let's work towards that. Let's have real dialogue and real conversation about what it means to get there, what it means to exist as that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you brought a lot of great points. And I think going back to what Mary asked about, and why isn't there a level of accountability taken from people when there's dissolution of governments? And I think what often happens is that political parties often become associated with an entire ethnic region. And when there are faults at stake, and then there's dissolutions of governments, we see that political leaders aren't loyal necessarily to Ethiopia's best interest. They're loyal to whoever's in power. And we see that happening a lot of times in transitional government. I know the former Prime Minister Hailemariam Desalegn, he was a close confidant of Meles. And then upon him becoming the Prime Minister, he said, we being the EPRDF, brought peace, democracy, and development to the country. And he said that he wanted to continue Meles's legacy without any change. And as you see what he's, the articles he's writing now, it's kind of a complete disassociation. And this is not just him, this is a lot of people of current regimes that were very heavily involved in, and they're now picking apart and critiquing. And every, I think, political party in Ethiopia and outside is not exempt from criticism, and we should welcome criticism. But what I'm kind of finding is that being critical of governments, especially I think in Ethiopia and just the African continent, is not accepted and is misconstrued as not being an Ethiopian nationalist in a negative way. So any critiques of what I'm seeing right now on Ethiopia's war on Tigray, any critiques about the humanitarian aspects or the aerial bombardments on civilian populations in Tigray, it's kind of in defiance of the ENDF, and you are anti Ethiopia, and essentially you are a TPLF operative if you, you know, basically point out any war crimes. When we see after Hachalu's death, and you know, in just a matter of months, I think in it was like over 9,000. Subsequently, tens and thousands of more have been political prisoners, majority of which are Oromo. And you're seeing that now. I think with Abiy, we're going back to the idea of, you know, what did he come in? I think he definitely oversimplified the challenges that he was facing. He mentioned frequently how his mom thought he was going to be a king of Ethiopia. And I think it's a growing belief in other ethnicities that he believes himself to be the Messiah for Ethiopia. And I think in these past 2 years, he was humbled in a huge way, both in domestically in Ethiopia and on the international stage. And we can see that the fact that the international community is kind of realizing and turning against him is greatly troubling him. One of the things that I think he was really, what he really did well when he first came, you know, there was all this Abiy mania, and, you know, he basically did like tours across the country and even the United States, kind of saying, I'm here, I'm going to be, you know, the savior of Ethiopia. With that over simplification, I think, and with the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize, I think people, you know, there's the tagline, which I think is very true. It kind of gave him a license to kill. So he was supposed to be this reformer, and he did, you know, welcome Jawar Mohammed and release political prisoners. And he was supposed to be this new beacon of hope. And that was quickly subsided. You know, what we see now is complete and utter chaos happening in Ethiopia, huge displacement, internal displacement at that, in the millions, increase in ethnic violence, abductions, extrajudicial killings, and the growing call from regional governments to for self-determination, which allows is part of the constitution, in fact. And granted, we have to also emphasize the fact that this guy was not elected by the people. His main purpose is to serve within the transitional government. And, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize kind of did a disservice in awarding someone that early. We can talk about, you know, whether or not they should award people who are in politics and haven't finished their term, but that could be another discussion. And I think for what people don't realize with the brokering deal, I think even Eritrea realized, like, hey, this isn't, you know, what we expected this to happen in terms of their peace deal agreement. And it's very strange that the specifics of such peace deal agreements were never specified, and frequent trips in between the countries, you know, befriending a dictator, smiling and laughing for in, I mean, Isaias, it's no secret that he is an enemy for TPLF and an enemy for a lot of Tigrayans and other Ethiopians. So consistently befriending a dictator, the phrase comes to mind is like, you are a representation by the friends you keep, the company you keep. And that is very telling. And I think what we see is a quick downfall. I think he knew that he would not receive probably majority vote if open elections were held this year. He masked it as a COVID kind of, COVID being the reason as to why it was postponed, and basically providing no end date, so to extend his term indefinitely, and used the war on Tigray in the same way that Trump uses many multiple reasons as to his incompetence and failure to lead the country, and unifying, his hope is to unify Ethiopia all against TPLF. And that actually trickled down, I think, into a lot of anti-Tigrayan sentiment as well. And what we're seeing now is just huge amounts of ethnic profiling, massacres, and this is not specific to Tigray by any means. Mass detentions. Tigray is just the largest conflict happening currently right now. And, you know, even when you were mentioning earlier about Hachalu, and, you know, I was just like watching old music videos recently and just hearing his interviews. I'm not gonna lie, I do not understand, but you know, just you can kind of feel that the sentiments, and you know, in translated interviews, and just like, he wasn't just a singer, he was a very important voice for the Oromo people, and he was a political activist. And I think about how he performed, I believe it was at kind of a celebration for when between Abiy and Isaias, and here he was like using his stage, this international stage, to also put a voice for the, you know, plight of the Oromo people. And to see what happened subsequently, where he criticized Abiy and a week later he was murdered, and that was largely used by the federal government as an excuse, the unrest of the protest, to basically mass arrest a lot of Oromos in opposition. And that was just, you know, and using the guise of, you know, terrorism charges, and basically the fact that he said they were trying to incite violence amongst other people. I mean, this was an elaborate plan to, how can we easily silence our oppressors? He kind of used, and even OMN, we saw that was shut down, again, to limit the voice of his opposition. And this is a tactic that is not specific to Abiy, but like I mentioned, we have more exposure, there are social networks, we can share information faster. And I think even everything he kind of stood for, the idea of what he stood for, in paper, it sounded really good. It's in a speech, it sounds really good. We're gonna have, we're gonna welcome opposition members. We're gonna have, people should feel free to live wherever they want in Ethiopia as an Ethiopian national. You don't have to fear of ethnic-based hate crimes, things of that nature. And that's all been dismantled in the course of a year. And I think it's really crazy to see even his statements on, you know, Twitter saying that they don't want any international mediation and things like that. And you think, how could you open your arms to international aid and praise and close the door on international criticism? It's absolutely ridiculous. And what we can see is classic signs of a dictator, oppressing media, arresting opposition members, making himself akin to like a king or a savior or messiah, and, you know, subvertly kind of promoting ethnic tensions. Even what we see now with his press secretary and his Twitter account, which was the state of emergency fact check, which is the most ridiculous thing. How can a government fact check itself? It's absolutely ridiculous. But what we're seeing now is that a lot of his opposition, in large part, is being dehumanized. And in a historical context, we know that the dehumanization, oftentimes of ethnic minorities, leads to huge massacres and genocides. And what we're seeing is, you know, even in the context, I'm just speaking specifically in the context for what's happening right now with Tigray and TPLF. And this is not to say that anyone needs to be pro TPLF or anything. Nobody is exempt from criticism in Ethiopia's history. And I think we can all agree with that. And, you know, what we see is refugees, over 40,000 refugees have fled. They've fled witnessing, some of them experiencing rape, some of them escaping death. And now the fact that the press secretary and the federal government is basically saying, you know, there's TPLF infiltrators amongst the refugees. So basically any testimony that they have should be brought up with skepticism. What they're essentially telling the rest of the world, and you can see this, I mean, the rise in hate speech, I see it super prominently in Facebook and Twitter against Tigrayans. And, you know, they say TPLF, but you can see under that guise, like what it's really aimed to. And it's anytime you know, you'll have video footage or interviews, and then they'll have refugee statements of genocide and attacks being made with them. And you just see it's almost as if they're not considered to be humans anymore or citizens of Ethiopia. It's like a foreign being, or the loss of humanity is really saddening to see amongst Ethiopians. They're just kind of, you know, when people are providing testimonies, then we hear stuff like, okay, fake news. They're trying to bring Ethiopia down. And this is not specific to this. Even, you know, I saw that Omen has one of their bases in Minnesota, in the US. And there was actually a petition in July, and it said Ethiopians calling for the governor to shut down OMN, you know? And then here it is. It's like, okay, when you say Ethiopians, who is the Ethiopians that you're referring to? Like, who is this, and what is their aim? Is the Oromo Media Network, which, you know, serves for Oromos, are they not Ethiopians? Is their voice, why is their voice need to be silenced? And oftentimes what we see is that any voice of the opposition, as mentioned before, is considered anti-nationalist. And that has to be swiftly dismantled, because it's rapidly leading to dehumanization of large populations. I saw something yesterday where it said, you know, we have to get a TPLF no matter what, even if we have to bomb all of Mekelle. Mekelle is only like half a percentage of Ethiopia, it's fine. And largely, he was largely condemned, which is a good sign from his friends and stuff like that at such atrocious things. But when you're hearing the level of hate speech, and granted, this is not something that started now. I think there was tensions. And I think oftentimes what I'm also seeing is that a lot of Ethiopians based in Ethiopia, they're saying that the diaspora is the one that's really causing tensions. And that, you know, and then they'll show old clips of like an Amhara and Oromo best friends and say, see, we live together peacefully forever. We're best friends. This notion that there's ethnic tensions and turmoil in the country is non-existent. And we have to realize that, you know, Ethiopia does have very repressive freedom of speech rights. You will be jailed, killed, or just you will essentially disappear if you show anything that is against the approved norm by the government. And so we have the liberty to speak with an open voice, and we should use our voice to openly criticize wrongdoings, not just of our ethnic-based region, but for everybody that we see. And what we see in large part is that there's a growing amount of dissatisfaction for the government, and I would say even growing hatred, and resultingly, you're seeing a lot more authoritarian action being placed on those in opposition. And I think we have to be cautious and check people when we do see them stepping out of line and kind of leaving their, I guess, humanist approach to what's happening, not just specific to Tigray, but to, you know, mass arrests, mass killings everywhere. And that's something we really need to be aware of.
You kind of said, like, kind of answered all my questions in one.
I was gonna say, I was like, wait, I forgot.